Our eighth case for this morning is Sam Brooks v. Colvin, 1325-29. Are you Mr. Pierre or Mr. Pierre?
Pierre, Your Honor.
Pierre. Okay, Mr. Pierre.
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Eddie Pierre Pierre, and I represent the appellant, Tammy Sam Brooks, on appeal from the Commissioner of Social Security's decision that she is not disabled and entitled to Social Security disability benefits. The ALJ failed to properly evaluate the medical evidence using the correct legal standards, and in turn failed to properly determine Ms. Sam Brooks' residual functional capacity based on substantial evidence. Ms. Sam Brooks has three treating physicians in this case, two of whom treat for her physical condition, and a third is a treating psychiatrist. Regarding the earliest of her treating physicians, Dr. Carroll, the ALJ stated that he gave little weight to Dr. Carroll because of the lack of objective support, as well as conflicting evidence of the claimant's function. The conflicting evidence that the ALJ refers to was Dr. Carroll's opinion that Ms. Sam Brooks was limited to sitting, standing, and walking for up to 1 hour in an 8-hour competitive workday, as compared to the function report that Ms. Sam Brooks completed. So, in essence, the ALJ basically found that Dr. Carroll's opinion with regard to her standing was at odds with the function report that she completed.
The ALJ finds problems. I'm looking at page 9 of 14 of the ALJ's opinion with Dr. Carroll's assignment of the very severe functional limitations, doesn't find support in the record for that, and also finds that Dr. Howard contradicts himself in the psychiatric impairment questionnaire and other notes. And so that's why the ALJ kind of defaults back to the agency doctors.
That is correct, Your Honor. But if we look closely at, beginning with Dr. Carroll, if we look closely at his opinion and his records, the doctor first of all cites severe pain, pain in the L5 region, severe burning, stinging, and muscle pain, in addition to diagnoses of depression and anxiety, and he further cites x-rays. And that's at the administrative record at page 345. Most of, if not all of the Dr. Carroll's treatment notes note the disc disease in the L5 region, that she suffers from chronic pain, obesity, and also bipolar depression. And all of the treatment notes further include medications that the appellant is taking or being prescribed for all of those conditions. In particular, there's loss that I bring to the court's attention, which is indicated for moderate to moderate severe pain. And we know that Dr. Carroll's opinion is later further supported by MRI testing that was done of the cervical spine that revealed a herniated disc that abutted the spinal cord, an MRI of the lumbar spine that revealed degenerative disc disease, and x-rays that he also mentioned that also revealed degenerative disc disease. So there was objective support in the record.
In other words, you're saying there's much more objective support for the underlying conditions that caused the pain than his simple acceptance of her self-report.
That is correct, Your Honor. The appellant also underwent physical therapy, during which time she had three epidural injections, one of which I believe was in her neck. She also underwent physical therapy. If I turn to the Dr. Howard's opinion, if I may for a moment, to respond to the court's inquiry, Dr. Howard's opinion, the reason the ALJ gave Dr. Howard's opinion little weight is because he found it to be contradicted by Dr. Howard's own clinical findings. But the only thing the ALJ refers to in that respect is the GAF score of 60 that Dr. Howard assigned to the appellant. However, as this court has advised, the ALJ should have actually analyzed Dr. Howard's treatment notes to see if they were consistent with the mental residual functional capacity that he provided in terms of an opinion regarding Ms. Sambrook's functioning. If the ALJ would have performed that analysis, he would have found that actually the limitations as indicated by the doctor were consistent with his treatment notes. Dr. Howard's opinion, as he states, was based on evidence of poor memory, sleep disturbance, mood disturbance, difficulty thinking or concentrating, social withdrawal, decreased energy, and isolation. All of this was consistent with the claimant's complaints at during visits with him, and also by her previous psychiatric medical providers that date as far back as December 2009. That's when she was treating at Regional Mental Health, and her treating psychiatrist there was Dr. Rodriguez. And that's found at page 307 is one of the pages where that's found. She treated at Regional Mental Health from about December 2009 till about March 2010. The same symptoms that she presented with at Dr. Howard also presented at Regional Mental Health. Moreover, as this court has heard...
So let me ask you this question. As in so many of these cases, you know, we've got a bunch of doctors, different specialties in this instance, given Ms. Sandbrooks's problems, who all conclude essentially that she's not capable of regular full-time work and thus would support a finding that she's disabled. Then you have, you know, a couple of other doctors, and the ALJ decides to believe the doctors who think she can work, not the doctors who think she can't. So what's, given the limited role of this court in the substantial evidence test, what's your strongest argument for saying we should tell the ALJ, or the Social Security Administration more broadly, that there is a reversible problem here? What went wrong?
What went wrong, Your Honor, is essentially that the ALJ misread the evidence, if you will, of the treating physicians. Because as I articulated, there's plenty of objective support in the record for the findings or the opinions of Dr. Carroll and Dr. Kelly. Those are the doctors who treat the physical condition. And again, there's objective or clinical support for the opinion of Dr. Howard, the psychiatrist. The ALJ relied on two non-examining doctors, neither of whom had the benefit of all of those treating physicians' records because their opinions were rendered prior to the claimant or the appellant treating with those doctors. It's unclear what records they had to review when they gave those opinions. I should also point out for this court that the appellant also was examined by two Social Security doctors, which the ALJ doesn't really mention what weight he gives to them. And notably, the psychologist who reviewed the appellant gave her assigned a gap of 50, which was even much more severe than Dr. Howard's assignment of a gap of 60, which the ALJ pretty much rejected. So the error here, to sum it up, that the ALJ really committed here was not to properly evaluate the medical evidence, which is at odds with this court's ruling in a string of cases, Jelinek v. Astru. In addition, the ALJ failed to, if he wasn't going to give controlling weight to those treating physicians, he failed to apply the various factors that the regulations require he apply so that he can articulate what value he assigns to those treating physicians. And we don't see that anywhere in this opinion. And the ALJ commits a serious error, in the misreading of the function report completed by the appellant and the appellant's husband. And his misreading of those reports permeates the decision in that it infects his opinion, his analysis of Dr. Kelly's opinion. He says it's not credible, and he uses the function report to say it's not credible. And then again, when he does the credibility analysis, or what he calls a credibility analysis, he again finds that it's at odds with what she reports in the function report. But if we read the function reports, they're very consistent. She talks about not being able to think straight. She can't sit or stand for long periods of time. She remains in bed. Her husband fills out a function report 3 months earlier, says essentially the same thing. She presents to Regional Mental Health. She says the same exact thing about staying in bed, not really being able to care for her kids, moving closer to her husband's family. And with that, the appellant would submit that this case should actually be reversed for a calculation of benefits because the only conclusion that could be reached is that the plaintiff is disabled. Alternative, we would remand the claim for further evaluation.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Pedersen?
Good morning. May it please the court, opposing counsel. Danielle Pedersen on behalf of the Commissioner of Social Security. Ms. Zambrooks, through her attorneys, has come forward in the brief and in the argument this morning to give a lot of reasons that the other reasons and other factors the ALJ might have considered or might have relied on to have weighed differently the physician opinions of record. What she has failed to do, however, is to address head-on the primary reason the ALJ gave for giving little weight to these opinions, and in fact, that was also the same reason that the district court cited for upholding this decision, and that is the very extreme nature of these opinions. There is evidence in the record. There is objective medical evidence in the record. There are certainly MRIs and X-rays and some fairly modest clinical findings. That's not to say that those findings don't support that there were impairments here.
Well, there's quite a bit in this record, actually, and I'm concerned about two things. I'm concerned about the ALJ's minimization of what she's saying, saying, for example, she's complaining about wrist pain and diminished grip strength, but she's actually complaining about much more: chronic pain in the neck, pain all the way down the right arm into the hand, decreased grip strength, and so on. But those are specifics. I also just don't see this ALJ looking at this woman's problems, both mental and physical, taken as a whole, and conveying appropriately to the vocational expert the degree of limitation. Obviously, the vocational expert's opinion is going to be only as good as the accuracy of the hypothetical given to the VE. And I, frankly, can't even imagine somebody like this functioning in full-time work. But disregarding the actual treating physicians for these reviewing people who don't even have a full record in front of them is very troublesome.
Well, Your Honor, first of all, to say that this individual, you'd be surprised you could do any work, if you look at the consultative examination, it's essentially normal. Other than some very mildly reduced range of motion in the neck and the back, every other clinical finding on that exam was normal.
She's got all sorts of problems. I mean, you would agree that she's treated very continuously by medical facilities, whether it's epidural injections or whether it's physical therapy or whether it's going for more x-rays. She's constantly back seeing doctors, and doctors aren't that much fun to see. So you have to feel like, you know, the doctors are doing something professionally appropriate when they're doing this. And she's got the mental problems overlaid. She's got some serious mental problems. Bipolar, she shoplifts all the time. She's got a lot of problems.
Well, actually, Your Honor, she doesn't shoplift all the time. There's one incident of shoplifting that happened at the very beginning of the record. That was during a time when she was not being treated properly for her bipolar. It's actually in the record. The doctor indicated that when he first saw her, he said, "This is not the type of treatment that I would expect to see from someone with a bipolar diagnosis."
But she admits to shoplifting more than 100 times in the 2 years before her arrest.
Subjectively, that is her statement, Your Honor. That is true. That is not actually something, though, that is in the record before the ALJ as far as those incidents being documented and things of that nature.
Why would you say that?
One of the overriding things that is for the ALJ, however, is her substantial obesity. I've forgotten what it was now. But that doesn't seem to make any difference to him.
I'm sorry, doesn't seem to make any difference to who?
To the ALJ.
Well, I don't think it's that it didn't make any difference to the ALJ. The physician opinions that he specifically relied on in his decision actually clearly noted the claimant's weight in their records, and they obviously took that into consideration.
Well, no, not obviously. Did they say something about it? Did they say what this did to functionality? Or did they just say she weighs 245 pounds?
They did note her weight in the record, Your
Honor.
That's
all they said, though. They didn't say, "and thus."
Well, no, what they did say, though, is that they looked at the consultative exam, which showed that she walked with a normal gait, she was able to get on and off the examination table with no problems, she didn't have any range of motion problems related to her body habitus, she only had the mild decreases related to a back and a neck impairment. No physician, in fact, cited Ms. Sambrook's obesity as being a factor in their opinions. Neither Dr. Carroll nor Dr. Kelly cited her weight or her obesity in their treatment notes, nor did they include that in their opinions. Dr. Carroll seems to rely only on the subjective complaints because the only clinical evidence he cites in his report is pain.
We need to take pain seriously. There's a real relation or at least ALJs frequently find one, between morbid obesity and lower back pain, knee and hip pain, and the body's being asked to carry more than it was designed for.
And, Your Honor, that is why I think the ALJ gave this claimant such a limited RFC. This is not your typical light work with a sidecar of a couple mental restrictions. This is a very, very detailed and very limited RFC. That, and the ALJ talked about why the different limitations were included and which accommodation, how those accommodated her various impairments. Even though the ALJ found there wasn't much support for the right arm problem, the ALJ did include limitations involving the use of the right arm and hand in the RFC. The ALJ also reduced the amount of time that she would need to do some of the postural movements associated, even though at the consultative exam she was able to make those movements without any difficulty. The ALJ also greatly limited the amount of weight she could lift. In fact, his RFC is even more restrictive than that of the state agency physicians upon whom he gave great weight to. Again, I think that the problem here is that Ms. Sandbrook seems to be arguing that if there's any evidence in the record, any objective evidence of an impairment, that somehow automatically supports a finding that the person can only sit for an hour.
No, of course not. It's that, you know, she's got all of these issues, you know, addiction to the pain medication, the back pain, you know, the bipolar disorder, the weight, these are all documented. Again, lower back and neck pain. She's this isn't just somebody, you know, who comes in, you know, with an imagined pain. She's got the chronic radiating pain. She keeps saying 8 to 8 on a 10-point scale, 7 on a 10-point scale.
Your Honor, this is basically every Social Security disability case that I see in my 15 years is the pain levels being at level 9. But the reason the ALJ can't always credit those subjective statements is because there has to be objective medical evidence.
And there is. She's got all these bulging discs and so on. This isn't, you know, the fibromyalgia people, or it's not, you know, all these others. We've seen plenty of the people you're talking about too, but it's taking everything as a whole and making sure that you're looking at all of the medical testimony, not just a couple of state agency paper reviewers.
Well, and again, had the treating physicians in this case rendered reasonable opinions that were actually more in line with the objective evidence, it's very possible the ALJ would have given them more significant weight in this case.
You don't think pain can exceed that which the underlying medical condition might suggest to you?
I absolutely think that, Your Honor, but I also know that our regulations, and they're written the way they are, and they cannot be changed at this between, you know, now and when this ALJ wrote the decision. The ALJ has to find that the doctor's opinions are supported by the evidence. And when you have normal clinical findings, normal examinations, and then you say she can't even sit for an hour, or they say she has these marked environmental limitations, that she can't have gases or fumes or things of that nature, there's absolutely no, not even a complaint in the record of a condition that would cause those types of limitations. In fact, plaintiff herself testifies that she has no trouble breathing and no shortness of breath. I think what the ALJ did was see these opinions for what they were, extreme opinions that seemed to be taking her subjective complaints at face value and rendering these opinions without proper objective support. And in the absence of properly supported treating physician opinions, the ALJ did what he had to do, which was consider the other medical opinions of record, and finding those more in accord with the evidence, he gave those opinions greater weight.
And he also overweighs what the daily activities are, but we see that a lot. You know, she says she's in bed all the time, and, you know, if it takes her an hour to do the dishes, who cares? But I think that the daily activities are overweighed by the ALJ.
What was one factor that the ALJ considered was the daily activities. There were certainly a host of other factors the ALJ considered.
I think throw any light. I mean, they certainly don't suggest she can do anything. Maybe they suggest she can't.
No, they certainly don't. But at the same time, the ALJ is allowed to contrast what plaintiff is saying with what the record shows. And for someone who was able to walk into several different exams at different times and not have any major problems on a clinical examination, an objective finding on an MRI is one thing, but it has to be clinically correlated. And that's absent in this record if you look carefully. There simply aren't the types of significant objective findings in the record that would demonstrate that this woman needs to be in bed all day or that she's not able to sit or stand for any period of time. Because the physician opinions were so extreme and because plaintiff's complaints were also extreme, the ALJ properly contrasted those with the evidence. And
okay.
We ask that you affirm that decision.
All right. Thank you very much. Anything further, Mr. Peer? here.
May it please the court. My adversary responds to refers to extreme nature of the treating physician's opinions. I point out to the court that the treating physicians, Drs. Carroll and Kelly, gave their opinions at three different points in time, all of which were the same, and I think what my adversary refers to is the limitation on the ability to sit, stand, and walk of up to 1 hour in an 8-hour competitive workday. I point the court to the many other restrictions in those same questionnaires, any combination of which would render the appellant at less than sedentary capacity and unable to work. As it pertains to the psychiatrist, I see my time is concluded.
Finish your
As
thought.
It pertains to the psychiatrist, Dr. Howard, when he completed his questionnaire, you'll note he had the option of rating not ratable on evidence, mildly limited, moderately limited, markedly limited, and not limited. No evidence of limitation. If we look at that questionnaire, he indicated markedly limited in several areas of functioning, but also indicated no evidence of limitation in some and moderately limited in others. And so the point was it was a well-thought-out questionnaire that he completed on behalf of his patient.
All right. Thank you very much. Thanks to both counsel.
Thank you.
We'll take the case under advisement.